And I was sort of feeling the opposite. So I had this aha moment where I was like, my gosh, the traditional hotel model is just totally broken. It's gone in the last 30 years, you know, since the first franchise hotel or whatever in the 1970s or 80s, it's become so standardized with just a full drive to standardize. I think we've lost our soul in travel. This isn't the industry I want to be a part of. I don't feel right about it. And I'm going to try and make some changes here.
Welcome everybody to the Glamping Podcast, powered by the American Glamping Association. On today's episode, we are joined by Peter Mack, the founder and CEO of Collective Retreats, a luxury glamping retreat operator with locations in the Texas Hill Country, Governor's Island, outside of New York City, Vail, Colorado, Yellowstone, and Hudson Valley, New York. What I love about this particular conversation is that this is a story about a founder's love for the outdoors and hospitality. It was ingrained in him at a young age, which ultimately sent him on a journey of learning experiences that would eventually shape his vision for Collective Retreats, which is really based on the recognition that change within an industry was needed. No story in this space is a direct line A to B. We take various pit stops or wrong turns or walkabouts, if you will, to get to our ultimate starting line. There's rarely a lightning bolt moment where we are struck and then immediately leave everything behind, head out the front door, and start our glamping business. Within this industry, there is a necessary level of slow burn that we encounter that helps us shape our vision through consistent sanity checks. I often say that I have yet to bear witness to a glamping project that hasn't had to show a high level of scrappiness and grit just to get off the ground. And Peter's story shows us that firsthand, with the first glamping property in Vail, Colorado as that perfect example. What can often be the most rewarding, exciting, yet challenging aspect of starting a glamping business is the feeling that there isn't a model to go off of that perfectly matches our intentions. But what I hope this conversation brings to light is that the most important part of starting out is creating and putting ourselves, really forcing yourself into an environment where you have to make it real. Because as Peter shows us, amazing things can happen when we bet on ourselves. Enjoy. Welcome everybody to the Glamping Podcast, brought to you by the American Glamping Association. Today we are joined by Peter Mack, the founder of Collective Retreats. Peter, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ruben, and thank you for all the work that you and the American Glamping Association have been doing, because I think it's really fantastic for our space, and it's needed now more than ever.
Peter, I appreciate that, and thanks for that. And you know, I know that you're based in Colorado. You're currently talking to us in Florida, but tell us a little bit more about where'd you grow up, and give us a little bit of insight to kind of the childhood of Peter Mack.
You got it. I grew up in the northeast of the United States, so originally New Haven, Connecticut, and I spent a lot of time, and my family actually sort of spent a bunch of time growing up in Vermont. So between Connecticut and Vermont was my childhood home. When I was young, I got to spend a lot of time in the outdoors, and New England is just beautiful, a beautiful place to do that. And so grew up in the Northeast, then ended up going to school in upstate New York and lived in New York City for quite some time after university. Until I moved to Colorado, which is about six, seven years ago now, the majority of my life was in the Northeast between New England and New York.
And growing up, as you said, you spent a lot of time in the outdoors. Was that something that was kind of mandatory in your family? You guys had your set trips that you would do? Was it something that you enjoyed, was popular, or walk us what that was like?
Super mandatory in my family. So we always spent a lot of time in the outdoors, but especially my father, who still is a ski bum, used to take us into the mountains a ton. And that was very mandatory, sometimes mandatory to the point where you as a child, you wouldn't even necessarily love every minute of it. But yes, it was mandatory. And I spent a lot of time in the summers as well. Another mandatory thing in my family was in the summers, spent a lot of time camping and, you know, rock climbing and hiking and learning all of the things about outdoor survival and stuff like that. And so, yeah, the outdoors was definitely a big part of my childhood.
And walk, I feel like every family or growing up, there was maybe one trip that, or was there like a consistent trip that you guys would typically do? Was there kind of one that really stood out to you guys or?
Yeah. So there was, for me, it was mostly that my father, who's always been into mountains, it was that whenever there was snow on a mountain, we would get picked up at school before the last bell rang, be on our way to that place where there was snow on a mountain, and we'd be up at 8 a.m. skiing or doing something else in the outdoors. And that was kind of mandatory. And it wasn't, it was religious, I would say. It wasn't even mandatory. So yeah, for us, it was this, I was very fortunate. My parents had, when I go think back as far as I can remember, probably being, I don't know, 5 years old or 6 years old or something, my parents had one of those big old Jeep Grand Wagoneers. Do you know that car? It's got the wood paneled side. I actually wish I still owned one today. They cost an arm and a leg because they're antiques. Back then, I think it was a little different, but had one of those big kind of woody Jeep Grand Wagoneers. It was navy blue with the wood paneling on the sides. And I had a couple older brothers, and even until I was well into my teens, being the youngest, I always had to sit in the middle in the back. And it was all about piling into that car and driving up to the mountains. And for my dad, his passion for skiing and the mountains and the outdoors is something that has been ingrained in me religiously. It's definitely much more spiritual than anything else.
So growing up, you guys have, you know, this access to these great spots, in the mountains, doing skiing, doing camping, doing a lot of outdoor activities that were, you know, just mandatory expeditions through, you know, through with your father and with your family. As you fast forward a little bit and you go to, you know, let's just call it the 10-year-old Peter Mack. At that age, did the 10-year-old Peter Mack have an idea of what he wanted to do when he was all grown up?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the 10-year-old Peter Mack was just evolving from wanting to be a fire engine when I grew up, not wanting to be a fireman, but wanting to be a fire engine into something else. And I think at the time I did, I think actually my desire was to be some version of either, I remember wanting to either be an explorer, like a National Geographic photographer. I was inspired by some great photographers when I was young, and I used to spend a lot of time doing photography and in the dark room. So I'd spend a lot of time outdoors, and I loved old school single lens reflex cameras, you know, old school black and white film. When I was young, I spent in high school, my high school had this great dark room, which was like such an asset. I'd spend hours and hours in there every week, sometimes every day, because on the weekends I'd be out in the outdoors with the camera. And yeah, so I spent all this time kind of developing, you know, I don't know if did you ever spend any time in an old school dark room, black and white photography? You know, you'd sit there with the developer and then the stop bath and then the fixer, and you'd have to hang the thing and let it drip all under a red light in a dark room. And at that time, I think I wanted to be a National Geographic photographer. I also had a dream at the same time of just being a chairlift attendant, you know, like a lifty. And I have lots of friends that actually did that kind of post high school, post college. But I loved skiing. I still do. And I would look at the chairlift attendants, and for some reason, I thought that that was like an awesome way to ski a lot. And I don't think, ironically, I think that if you're a lifty, you actually don't get to ski that much. You know, you get your days off. So maybe I didn't have the right idea then, but I was fascinated by mechanics of chairlifts. And, you know, now that I live in Colorado, I get to see them a lot more often. So I think back then it was somewhere between a National Geographic photographer and a chairlift attendant, which were both really cool jobs. I mean, if you ever look at lifties, especially if you're a kid, they're always like these cool looking guys with like tattoos up and down their neck and like list dancing to cool music while they're loading the lifts. Yeah. It just felt like a really cool job. You get to see all these people. Maybe that was where my passion for hospitality started. I'm not sure.
So if we get through, you know, that phase there, you're getting through high school, you graduate high school. You know, what happens next? Where do you go? What do? You go to school? Do you go work? And then, and more importantly, to follow up question there would be, at that point, as you look back, did you feel like you had the direction that you took and where you went? Was there a sense of conviction that was what you wanted to do? Kind of where was the mindset at that age?
Yeah, great question. So I what was your first job that you had, like high school or pre-high school or whatever? What was your first job?
When I was 14, was kind of very similar to your Lyfty conversation. I had a good friend that was ended up going to film school and was really big into movies. So we worked at the local movie theater thinking that I would be able to tear tickets and then we'd get to watch movies all day. We worked a lot, never got to watch movies, and we actually just cleaned the movie theaters.
Yeah, so I started out when I was, when I was 15, instead of being a chairlift attendant, because I was still in school at the time and I wanted to be able to do things in the outdoor on weekends, I actually wanted to be able to get a car and have gas and drive so that I could go and explore throughout New England. I was hung up at the time on hiking all 40 of the over 4,000, or all 46, I think, of the over 4,000 foot White Mountains, which by the way, once you move to Colorado and it's over 14,000 foot mountains, it's a little bit different, but the White Mountains are, I don't know if you spent any time in New England, they're really cool. And I loved being up in the summer, traveling through Maine and Vermont in the winter and things like that. I always loved the Northeast. So I wanted to be able to have freedom and drive. Freedom was huge to me as a kid. So I got a job, I think when I was in 10th grade, when I was 15, maybe 11th grade, got a job as a dishwasher at a local hotel. And it was just sort of a way to pay the bills, but very quickly, I mean, I can remember from my first week just loving hospitality and the people who I was surrounded by. And I've always felt that hospitality is part of a grand theatrical portion of our lives where you get to just put on a show every day for others. And being behind the curtain, even just as a dishwasher, just felt so cool. I mean, there were all these like really talented career bartenders and servers. And I got to like learn their trade from them as a 15-year-old. And I don't even know if it was legal at the time, but I got to go behind the bar and like flip drinks and stuff. And there were upsides and there were downsides to it. I remember the kitchen that I was in, I was a dishwasher for a while in high school, and the kitchen that I was in most weeknights, because I usually worked weeknights after school, most weeknights, it was just me and a chef in the kitchen. You know, the servers and the bussers would come in and out, but most of the time it was just me and a chef. And the chef was this larger-than-life man, and he was actually larger-than-life physically as well. And it wasn't a big kitchen, and I was warned about chef's fuel on my first day by the manager. And it turns out that this chef would fly back then. I don't know if it flies today, but this chef would drink every shift, from whatever prep starting at 2 PM until we'd close at 2 AM. He would drink an entire, bottle, like a liter bottle of Jim Beam.
Oh my God.
That was his chef. He called it chef's fuel. I think it was like a line item on the P&L for the restaurant. Uh-huh. And so in the beginning of the night, it would be really fun. This guy would be pulling from his whiskey bottle and we'd be having a good time. Later in the night, it would turn into him with like grease and hot ovens and a range throwing dishes at me. Not because he was a mean person. He was just drunk and it was a hot kitchen with a lot going on. And so every once in a while, as like a 15-year-old, I'd get like a chef's knife thrown at me like 20 feet away across the kitchen, or like a hot greasy pan just thrown with all the grease in it at me. So I came out of that job with a couple of burns and bruises and cuts, but for the most part, I loved it. And started out as a dishwasher. They very quickly, after, I don't know, 5 months or something, they made me a busser. And then I was a server, and then I got to bartend. And then the HR team at the hotel said, hey, do you want to do some time at the front desk? And so in high school, I survived the chef's fuel, and I was very quickly able to rotate through all of the roles in this local hotel. And I just loved it. I fell in love with hospitality. To me, like, working in a hotel was just the dream in every way possible. And so that, that solidified for me at a very early age, and it, it still is the dream. I mean, we get, I feel very privileged now that I get to work with this great team at Collective Retreats, but my desire every day is to still be at our retreats, you know, checking guests in and helping cook meals and doing all the things that we get to do that really make the magic for them. So when I was in high school, that translated, like, people saw my passion, and I would share that passion with others, and people very quickly told me I should go to hospitality school. And so I was sort of told that at 15 years old. And then I spent the next few years of my life, you know, I don't know that I didn't ever crush it in high school, or I probably, my SATs weren't the best in my class. I certainly wasn't the valedictorian, although my parents always put a very high emphasis on education. So I worked hard. And I just sort of really crafted my way to ensure that I could go to hospitality school. Ended up applying to hotel management school. And it's funny because nowadays in some of the hotel management schools, people apply to them and their dream is to go right into like hotel real estate finance or digital marketing for travel. I was like a real operations guy. I went to hotel school and I was a teaching assistant, a TA for food and beverage classes, you know, in the kitchen. We actually had these cool chef's learning kitchens with like 30 kitchens in one built in one space so that you could do. It actually looked a lot like Top Chef or something back before those shows even existed. And I was a TA for a lot of food and beverage classes. And I really took as many of the kind of operations classes as possible. And so for me, this is kind of weird because I have so many friends that kind of don't know what they want to do with their life every couple of years or whatever it may be. But like the dream has always been that. And I don't think it'll change. I guess I'm like a one track man. I think my life is going to be dedicated to hospitality because my passion for it has only grown and grown and grown.
So that's cool. So it was essentially stoked at a younger age through your first job, which, you know, I think is great. And, you know, I think rare too, that somebody can have one of their first gigs turn into what they end up doing as a successful career. But you're in high school, you know, you take this dishwashing job that turns into, you know, several other gigs that then sparks this passion around, hey, maybe I should go to hospitality school. And you went to, is that Cornell Hospitality School? Is that correct?
Yeah, I went to Cornell, the hotel school.
Cornell. And then you obviously graduate from Cornell, and then what happens next?
Yeah. So the path was a little circuitous. When I was at Cornell, I actually did have a couple hospitality jobs. My favorite one was bartending. And so I bartended all through college at this awesome bar in Ithaca, New York called the Royal Palm Tavern. Rest in peace. It's not there anymore, but it was this old school bar with, you know, the sort of real old school jukebox and, you know, rotting wood everywhere with initials carved into it. And each booth had like a little mini jukebox. None of them worked. But it was just this really, Ithaca has a lot of really cool history. It's one of these Northeast towns that has hundreds of years of history. And this bar was very much a part of that history. And it was really fun. And I remember, the place was a dive. I remember the day I was working there, the day that New York State banned smoking in bars and restaurants. And the next morning we all woke up and went into work. And like a day later, we realized the whole place just smelled like raw septic. Nobody ever noticed it because there was so much cigarette smoke. But like after they banned smoking, we had to like do a big septic system overhaul because the place was like so gross. Anyways, it was the most fun place to work. We'd stay, you know, all night having a good time. And I don't know if I did quite as much college work as I should have, but I was getting a hotel degree. So I guess that was part of it. When I became very involved in the Ithaca community. So I actually ran when I was an undergraduate in college, I ran for, I was very frustrated by the fact that there were some things that I didn't like that I saw around me in Ithaca, and no student at Cornell had ever, so students make up 50% of the population in Ithaca, New York. No student had ever held an elected office in Ithaca. And there was a city council seat open in my district. And when I was a junior in college, I ran for city council and actually got elected. I don't know what the citizens of Ithaca were thinking on that day, but they elected me. And so actually post-college, I had a term, I had a multiple year term on city council. And when I graduated from college, I stayed in Ithaca, which actually created a lot of really good opportunity for me. I was managing that bar and I ended up getting my pilot's license because I had some extra cash from work and bar. And I was a city council person. And that went on until a year or two after I graduated from college. So I stayed in Ithaca a little bit longer than otherwise maybe some students would have because I was on the Ithaca City Council. So what I learned while I was on the Ithaca City Council.
Did you ever think that you would take that on more, kind of graduate and do more public office work? Or
yeah, so I love local politics. You know, in every community that I've lived in, I've gotten somewhat involved at least. And I think that in the future, I'd love to go back into local politics more intimately. At that point in my life, what I had felt was missing was I love politics and I love local politics because local politics are so personal, right? It's not like in the Senate where, yeah, they say it's personal when they pass a big resolution for the whole country, but it's really not. Like in local politics, the things that you do influence your friends and family and the people right around you and yourself every day. And so it was really cool. And I learned I learned more about kind of empathy and working with people in that role than anything I've ever done. But what was missing from my life was I really wanted to kind of invest my whole self into hospitality. And so I when my city council term finished, I moved to New York City from Ithaca, which was a few hours away. I had a bunch of friends living there, which was exciting at the time. And I got a job working for Starwood Hotels and Resorts, which is now Marriott, which ended up turning into a 10-year kind of career run there. So I was missing, I sort of had this chunk of me that was missing. I really wanted to be like a hotel guy. That was like really ingrained in me. And when I finished my time on Ithaca City Council, I was able to jump right into the hotel world at Marriott. Corporate, actually. I was a corporate guy there. Yeah.
And so at that point, if we talk about the conception of the idea with collective retreats, you spent a little bit of time after Starwood at Tough Mudder. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And were you thinking of the idea of collective retreats at that point when you were at Starwood, or did it happen?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There was actually kind of an aha moment. So I'd been at Starwood for years, right? In total, I did about 10 years. And I think in my seventh year there, I don't know if it was seventh or eighth year there, I was in a job. I was working on sales and operations, and I was in a role where I was on the road over 250 days a year. It was like way too much. And so I was staying in all these really wonderful hotels. Starwood, now Marriott, was the portfolio that included St. Regis, W Hotels, Westin, Sheraton, Four Points by Sheraton, several others, Element Hotels, several others. And I was staying in all these really cool hotels. And I had this moment, I think I did a trip. I did a work trip for like a week to China, and I was in Shanghai. And then I had to go right from there to another work trip in Chicago. And I was staying at the Westin Chicago River North, which is, I think it's still a Westin. It's right on River North in Chicago. And I woke up and I looked out the window, and I don't know what time zone I'm on. I don't really know where I am, but I thought I was still in China because the Westin hotel rooms are so well streamlined, right? It's actually a really hard thing to do, to have tens of thousands of hotel rooms across the world that are all exactly the same. And Westin was one of the early brands to do that really well. They introduced the Heavenly Bed, which was a standardized bed, and they had Heavenly bath products and the robes and the desks. And it was all the features. The Westin standard room was like this iconic thing that was just everywhere. Which, by the way, Marriott should be commended on. Like, it's really hard to do that. And it's really impressive. But I had this moment where I was like, holy crap, people travel to Chicago or to China and they should be feeling Chicago or China. They should be totally ingrained in the local people, the food, the smells of the place, even though sometimes the smells aren't that great, the sounds, the culture. And I sort of looked out the window. I remember I was like looking out at River North in Chicago, which is a cool view, saying to myself, I don't know what city I'm in. I don't even know where I am. I just know that I have like my heavenly bed and my bath products. And by the way, for a lot of business travelers who have to travel all the time, that is a good thing, right? Like I'm not knocking that at all. Mm-hmm. You want creature comforts and you want them to be reliable. But I was like, you know, this isn't what travel is meant to be about. By the way, business travel is pretty transactional, right? Like people who travel 200 plus days a year, they're not traveling because they want to explore the world. They're traveling because they have it's like a means to an end. And it's pretty transactional. That should not be the soul of travel, right? Like I do believe that there should be at the heart of hospitality, if someone has to travel 200 days a year, you want to make them feel special. You want to make them feel good. You want to make them feel comfortable. But the soul of travel should be about connecting people to places and people and cultures that they haven't been before or had before. And it should change you. You should go through an emotional journey that changes you by connecting to those things. And I was sort of feeling the opposite. So I had this aha moment where I was like, my gosh, the traditional hotel model is just totally broken. It's gone in the last 30 years, you know, since the first franchise hotel or whatever in the 1970s or 80s, it's become so standardized with just a full drive to standardize. I think we've lost our soul in travel. This isn't the industry I want to be a part of. I don't feel right about it. And I'm going to try and make some changes here.
And did you know at that point, so as you have this aha moment, did it evolve and mold into something quickly? Or was that moment more of a, hey, I know that I'm looking for a change. I know more or less what it's not going to be. Now I'm going to start looking at what it could be. Or in that kind of brief moment, you knew that maybe this, you know, outdoor unique lodging, glamping was the answer.
Yeah. So the answer is both. Because of me, I knew that the way I wanted to travel was much more connected to the outdoors. That like, if you could stay in a beautiful tent for the night that was super connected, but you could have all those benefits of that Westin hotel, right? All those wonderful things like the awesome bed and the bathroom that was reliable right there and the food and all that kind of stuff. I knew that that was what I wanted. So I had the idea for what's now Collective Retreats kind of at that time. It wasn't fully formed. But at the same time, I sort of said to myself, I'm working for this amazing hotel company that I love. Why don't I take some time to kind of explore this more, get feedback, think about it. And so I did two things at once. I had the idea for Collective Retreats. And then I started to dig into the traditional hotel model. And what I learned from digging into the traditional hotel model was I had access to like, there was this guy at Starwood. His name was Rex Warren. He was our CFO. For North America. And he was just like the coolest guy. This was a guy who was a finance guy, but you'd go into his office and there was like SpongeBob SquarePants jumping out of a closet and he had weird music on and he was like dressed in like a total like Aloha Island shirt. And I had several mentors at Starwood, but I remember saying, hey, Rex, I want you to walk me through how hotels work financially, like really get me into it. And he loved it, right? I was probably 26 or 7 at the time. And he loved helping me. And he was just this awesome guy. One of the best hotel finance guys I've met in my entire life. One of the best guys I've met in my life. And so Rex Warren walked me through how finance works in the hotel world. And it's not, I mean, maybe it is what you think it would be, but the average person does not know much about how it works because it's pretty sophisticated. And it's the way that pushes and pulls happen financially are not what you'd expect, right? There's like hotel owners, and a lot of them are these big real estate guys. And then there's hotel managers and operators, and a lot of them are these real hospitality driven guys. And there's all these competitive forces. And so I dug into a hotel P&L, you know, profit and loss statement, and a hotel cash flow statement, and a standard hotel balance sheet. And I fortunately had these wonderful people to do it with, but these are all things you could get online or in a book now. And what I learned very quickly is hotels are really expensive to build. And there's aspects of hotels that are really expensive to operate. And from my perspective, some of those big costs that were being invested weren't really impacting what I thought was important, which was really connecting people to a culture, a place, et cetera. So after like months or maybe a year or two of work and learning more about how I was never a hotel finance guy. I was always a marketing operations, you know, strategy, other sort of stuff. Learning a lot about that, it occurred to me, if you could create a company where, at least in the beginning, you know, connection to the outdoors and sort of tents were the product, you could reduce some of these costs that seem not really sensible in all ways. And you could increase and heighten things about the experience that were really valuable to people, at least people like me. And so at the time I was doing two things. I was learning and trying to research and think about it, like you said, like the one side of it. And then the other side, I knew that collective retreats was the answer. I just wanted to prove it. And so I spoke to a bunch of like mentors, actually one of them, guy, Josh Lesnick, who now works at, he's our COO at Collective Retreats. And he was like, this idea is awesome. You should do this. And a number of mentors said, this idea is amazing. You should go do this. And this was probably back in 2000, I don't know, 12. But you've been at a Fortune 500 company now for a long time. And like startups are a real different beast, right? Starting something from scratch is a whole different ballgame. You might want to learn a little bit more about how to do that before you go do it on your own.
Yeah. And we walk, because I think that's fascinating where you're in this scenario, you got these mentors who are saying, this is a great idea. And I think every entrepreneur has a different journey.
Yeah.
But what I know, which is relatively true across the board, across any industry, is that, you know, there's this internal jumping off point that everybody goes through. Lots of people have great business ideas, but the difference between the idea and making it a reality is this internal struggle that everybody goes through, right? This internal dialogue of, yeah, this is a good idea, but, or yeah, my mentor said it was a great idea, but, because there really are a lot more valid reasons not to do the business than there are to do the business.
Yeah. So, there are so many more reasons not to do something like this than to do it. I totally get that.
Walk us through that jumping off point. What triggered the eventual jump for you to say, yes, I'm going to do this? And what was the first thing that you did? Was it just the multiple conversations with the mentors that really validated it? Was it more studying? Like, what was the trigger? And then really, what was the first step after that, that you kind of made it real?
Yeah. Well, it then took another probably a year or two years before it became very, very real. But you know what? Connection to the outdoors is so timeless that it didn't matter whether it was a year or 2 years, it could have even been five more years. What everyone in our industry and our space is doing, Ruben, is so timeless and so much part of humanity, which is a whole different topic, the time is always. It's not like for anyone who wants to get into this space and do things that connect people more to the outdoors and to themselves and to other people and culture, the time is always, right? There is more opportunity for humanity to do that, and it's frankly infinite opportunity. But to answer your question, so at some point I did two things. One, I said, okay, I got this cushy corporate career and that's great, and I love this company and I can always come back to this company. I'm going to go get a job at a funky startup where I actually learn how to build a business from the ground up, because that's something I've never had. And that's a skill set that will be applicable no matter what, right? I can bring that back to Marriott. I can bring that to my future, whatever it may be. It would just be exciting and fun. And, I had a friend who was actually starting Tough Mudder at this time, at this moment. He was a friend of a friend, but I did a bunch of networking. And actually, I looked at a bunch of different kind of startup jobs. And what I loved about Tough Mudder, for those of you who don't, or for those of listeners that don't know Tough Mudder, it's this wild company that's still around where you do these kind of competitive but teamwork-oriented obstacle runs, like really dramatic, muddy obstacle runs with fire, and you get electrocuted, and there's wild smoke, and you have to climb over mountains and duck under tunnels, and they're pretty wild. Very different. In fact, some ways it was the opposite of working at Starwood, where you like make people feel spa treatments and warm beds and cushy. It was like, how do you inflict pain on people? But I had a friend, his name was Will Dean, wonderful guy. He's the CEO of Tough Mudder, founder and CEO of Tough Mudder. He was actually a friend of a friend starting the company, and they were looking for someone with something like my background, some hospitality and some design and some product management kind of background, because they wanted a head of guest experience, which was a combination of, there was a team at Tough Mudder that oversaw how we created courses and obstacles. And we actually had this obstacle innovation lab that was wild. And I'll tell you about that another time.
But we
also needed to really invest in the guest experience, like food and beverage for events, which, you know, events have huge food. We do 20,000 person events, and there's a huge food and beverage and hospitality component and all this kind of stuff. And so I was given the opportunity to kind of jump away from a big corporate gig that I had done for almost 10 years and hop onto a startup. And it was a wild time. I mean, Tough Mudder was growing like crazy. it was such a cool team of people to work with and work for. And I spent a year and a half there. The whole time I knew, and I was very transparent about wanting to start my own business. So the company knew that, you know, everybody knew about it. And I think that's actually important, is there was a time, you asked about this, there was a moment at some point between when I sort of talked to these mentors about the idea, where I started socializing it with everyone who I care about, right? So my family, my friends, anyone who would listen, I'd talk about why Collective Retreats needed to exist and why I was going to do it. And I think that's very important, because it's completely irrational usually to start your own business or start your own concept, or, you know, leave comfort and do something hard, you know, whether that's psychologically or physically or whatever it may be. And the one thing that I found to be a theme for me was, the more I socialized it with people who I trusted and who I cared about, the more they would ask me about it and hold me accountable to it in the future. And when it got to that jumping off point to really start Collective Retreats, that was really key.
And if you, so as you fast forward, you are, you know, you've socialized it, you've left Marriott, you're with Tough Mudder, you're fully committed, right, to this idea.
Yeah.
You're putting in maybe behind the scene calories and developing, you know, the business plan to it. Walk us through kind of the getting to the point where you're moving significantly towards the property number one, right?
Yeah.
Walk us through the beginnings of that, where you're now dialed in, you've got a vision for property number one, and now you're going at it. What was that like?
Yeah. So I decided, there was a moment where I sort of decided, okay, it's time. And I lived in New York City. By the way, moving from New York City to the mountains of Colorado is a pretty wild life change. And it was in my 30s, I guess. And yeah, there was sort of a moment where I said, okay, this is the moment. It's been a couple years of thinking about this, working on it. I've actually changed my career in order to do this. I've socialized this with so many family and friends. And there was a moment where I said, I need to immerse myself in nature for this to work. So instead of continuing to live in downtown Manhattan, you know, with the 80-story buildings, all 200-story buildings all around, and subways and taxis and smog everywhere, step one for me was moving into the mountains, and I did that. Step two was a lot of ramen. I still love ramen, and, you know, I was investing all the money that I had, which was not a lot, into Collective Retreats, and so it was really important to be frugal and make it sustainable. And so I re-sparked my love for ramen, which, if you live in New York City, there's so many cool ramen shops. It's amazing. You know, you can buy, gosh, I think those packs of Top Ramen, you can buy like 50 of them for $5 or something, is like really cheap. And I was getting super creative with all the different ways you could eat ramen in the mountains, for dinner, for lunch, sometimes even for breakfast. Ramen and eggs go together great. And actually the move to Colorado started looking for a location to do our first retreat. And from both Starwood and Tough Mudder, I learned a lot about how to scout land. That was one of the things that I had set as an objective to learn. And so found a couple of potential locations. One of them worked really well, and it was really exciting. We leased, the first lease we did was just a very simple but good lease agreement. It was like, you know, I think I went onto LegalZoom or some website where you could just download a template lease, and I sort of worked with it. But that wasn't the moment when it was real, because at that, there was still like outs along the way. The lease was a short-term lease, and it, you know, they sort of were like, let's help you get off the ground, let's figure this out. I was still working side gigs to try and make ends meet. The real jumping off point, Ruben, was I had built like a one page or quick and dirty website in order to show the landowners what the concept was, right? Instead of just bringing them materials, I wanted a website to make it real. And one thing led to another, and we added the ability to book a room. And once we announced that that Vail was our first location, Collective Vail, which still operates today very successfully and is a beautiful retreat, out of nowhere came in the first booking. And that was the moment that really tipped it, right? That was the no turning back moment, because...
Did you have the tents up at that point in time?
No, nope. So we had a plan for it. Had a plan for it. There were a lot of things that all happened at once. Had a plan for it. Sort of had the property in place. It was moving in the right direction. But I kept sort of saying, "How do I make this work financially? you know, this is tricky. I'd saved up money, but not a lot. And we got this first booking. And by the way, I'm still very close friends with our first and earliest guests. And it was this booking. It was for multiple tents, multiple nights. And it was a family where the mother had just been diagnosed with a terminal illness. The kids were in college. They had no ability to see each other. This was kind of their one trip. They didn't really understand or know what the mother's future life was going to be like. And they had told me that in the comments section of booking. And I actually called and reached out to me. And it was a pretty healthy booking, meaning from a business perspective, you know, they were paying several hundred dollars a night for multiple nights, multiple tents. And I just felt this strong passion that what they needed was what I was envisioning. And I needed to do this for those people. I know the people well still. They come back to our retreats all the time and they're wonderful family. And that was the tipping point, was getting that. I saw an email on my phone that was the booking confirmation. And I was kind of like, holy cow, someone's just paid a couple thousand dollars for something that I haven't marketed, haven't built, and kind of know what I'm doing, but haven't done it yet. And that was booked, you know, that was booked in, I think March or April for July. It was a booking with a bunch of lead time on it. And so I said, okay, I've got my timeline and we can open well before that. And, let's do it. And that was what set it over the edge.
And as you open, so let's say that those guests are there, let's even just say after the guests check out, the first set, those specific guests, or maybe the ones at, you know, at the end of month one, you've been sacrificing to get this business up and running. You have been really, you know, and as we say, there's no operation that I know of to date that hasn't gotten off the ground without a high level of scrappiness. And to your point, the high level of scrappiness just to get this up and running, the guest checkout, you're now maybe looking up and taking a breath of air. That collective Vail Retreats, what was on the ground at that point in month two, three, during that first season, was that more or less in line with the vision that you had seen at the beginning when you were still at Starwood, or was it different?
No, it was exactly aligned with the vision. I would say that what we offered from a guest experience perspective, in fact, it's exactly aligned with what we're doing at Collective Retreats today. You know, we did this the first night we opened, we did this big, beautiful chef tableside farm to table dinner. And we had all these activities planned for the guests with fly fishing and horseback riding, and they were getting a massage in their tent. And we had a campfire that was just like the campfires we do now. What I will say is that the physical aspects of it were more of a, what I'll call a minimum viable product. You know, we've significantly advanced to deliver on that dream. We've significantly advanced how the infrastructure behind it works, the sort of physical pieces of it. But all of our tents had their own private bathroom at the time. All of our, you know, dining, which we take a lot of pride in, our food and beverage program. We have really cool chefs at all of our retreats, and we do these beautiful breakfasts, lunches, dinners, campfire side stuff. It was all there. It was just a little scrappy as to how we got there. You know, so we had some outside chefs that I was friends with doing all the cooking. Now we employ a lot of those chefs, which is great. You know, the original physical product met the level of expectation, but wasn't quite built to as, you know, it was built to satisfy all the codes and things like that, but not as quite as high of a quality standard as we have now. But you know, at the time I was surprised that these people were paying $350 a night or whatever it was, for this product, and getting those first few bookings validated that there was a market out there for that and people wanted it. And so instead of inching our way in, we went full bore at the experience that we have now.
And very similar to that, the jumping off point or the trigger point for even just property number one, at what point do you realize, all right, we've got something?
Yeah.
At what point do you realize, man, we probably have to move. If we want to scale, we might need to move pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Walk us through the mindset of going to property number two. And why not just stay at property number one? Looks like things are going well.
Yeah.
You know, it's up and running. You know, to start over all over again had to be an overwhelming thought.
Yeah, it was. Well, so there were two points. One was, honestly, our handful of first checkouts when guests checked out, it was just so clear to me that what we were doing was right, because the guests were just enthralled, captivated. Like, they were loyal. I mean, we have some of our earliest guests are like company advisors and investors now. They were so into it. Mm-hmm. And they certainly still stay with us, you know, very loyal Collective Retreats kind of cult members. But what was wild, Ruben, was you know, at the time I didn't have this vision of expanding to multiple locations. Our Vail location, we very quickly learned what was perfect about it, what wasn't, and it still is a great location. But I got a call, you know, after we'd been open for a month or two, I got a call from a landowner in Montana who's like, "I love what you're doing. We have a better location." And I was like, "Come on, we love our location." And he's like, no, it's a better location. And he sent me photos. He's like, "Drive out to Montana. I'll cover your room for the night." He's just like, "Come look at my place." And so I did. I planned a trip to do that after we closed for the season at Vail that year. We closed on, gosh, I'll never forget. We closed on October 16th. And literally, I think on October 18th, I got in the car and drove to Montana. And I sort of got there and I was like, holy cow, this is a better location. Mm-hmm. We need this. I saw the place, and you know, the concept behind what we do is about connection to place. And I saw the place and I was like, we need this. And I sort of looked at him. Wonderful guy. His name's Kevin. I looked at him and we still work with him. And I was like, we do need this. And he's like, yeah, let's do it. And the second location for us wasn't really a business plan move or anything like that. It was more just like, I saw this place and I was like, this is what the brand's about. We need this.
And even going into that conversation, was there the mindset that you wanted to have several locations after that? Or going to Montana, was there a sense of, hey, we're going to do two is going to be good. Or was there just too much going on that it wasn't really part of the thought process?
Well, there was a lot going on and it all happened very quickly. But at the same time as we were looking at Montana for location two, a friend contacted me to a potential investor who was really excited about what we were doing. And everything clicked into place at once. But that person was like, you need to scale this and I'm going to help you do it. I can put in a little bit of money and invest in this. I believe in what you're doing. By the way, that was a woman named Haley Barna, who's still on our board. She's fantastic. She still is very involved in Collective Retreats. She said, the world needs this. So I see that you're working on your second location. Let me help you, you know, finance and help make it the dream a reality for that second location. And also, I think you should be thinking about scaling this because what you're doing needs to be all over the world and country. And it was really the combination of those two things happening at once that kicked me into that gear. Because no, to your point, at the time, I was just head down. I mean, I was cooking breakfast every morning at 5 a.m. in Vail. I was keeping the books, the finances for Vail. I was the concierge at Vail. We had a couple of team members, but I was doing all the heavy lifting, so to speak, work. Or not all, much of the heavy lifting work. And there was not a free minute. You know, any free minute that I had, I was resting, sleeping, mm-hmm. which was only a couple hours a night. And there wasn't like free time. And it wasn't really like some grand scheme to build a bigger portfolio of locations. It was the confluence of finding a second location at the same time as a really cool investor being like, let's do this. Where we said, all right, we're going to focus on location two. If location one and two can work together, then why can't location one, two, three, and four work together? Mm-hmm. And that happened, you know, that was a long period of time, right? We opened Vail. The next year we opened Collective Yellowstone. The year after that, we opened Collective Hill Country. So it was really like each year for a couple of years, we opened a new location. It wasn't like we had some master plan where you push a button and open a bunch of places, which would have been impossible.
And even if you go back to that first season at Vail, let's just call it even towards the end of the first season, what are your friends and family saying? You've made a few lifestyle changes, right? You went from a corporate job, a cushy job. You left to go start Tough Mudder, which is a well-known brand, but still startup at that point in time. Oh, yeah. Then you moved to Colorado to be in the mountains to work on this idea. What are your friends and family kind of saying at that point in time? Did they get it? Did they see the potential? Or are they just supporting you along the way?
Yeah. I guess I'll start with my mom and dad. They're like the most loving parents a person could have. They're amazing. My dad was really pumped about it. My dad is a pretty entrepreneurial himself. And he was like, how can we help? And actually my parents helped me a lot in the first year or two, which was really cool. Like literally and physically. And other family and friends did too. Cassie Novick, our head of design, was on site helping build the first tents and set up the first rooms, and her parents helped. As, you know, her family, her brother, her parents were both helpful in getting it up. So it definitely took a village. But my friends and family, were very encouraging. I think they thought that I've always been entrepreneurial and they wanted to support that. I think a lot of them actually saw the thing, like they saw what we were building and they were like, oh yeah, I will stay here. I want to stay here. And that was really helpful. You know, my mom, a number of times along the way, my mom would be like, how about that really cushy job you could have had working at Starwood? Are you sure you want to be doing this? I mean, my mom is like the most wonderful, caring person, and she'd never be like, don't follow your dreams. She was very supportive of me following my dreams, but she's probably a little more risk averse and a little more cautious than I am. And she, along the way, she just kept asking, like, do you miss your old life? You know, living in New York City and working at a big hotel company and traveling all over the world, you know, business class or whatever I was doing. And she sort of held on to that. What's really cool is there became a point where she turned around and she's like, oh my gosh, this is the greatest thing you've ever done. It took a couple of years, but my family was very supportive. I have a father who is very entrepreneurial and he loved it. And my mother always taught me to follow my dreams, even though she wasn't in love with it at first. And I have a couple brothers that were super supportive and sisters-in-law and a bunch of friends that actually helped build the first locations. So yeah, it was important to have those people supportive. Now, what made them supportive is that for a couple of years, I had been communicating to them the dream. So they actually held me accountable to it. And once someone else starts to hold you accountable to it, you can ask for their help and hold them accountable to that. So there were people who were holding me accountable to my dreams. And then I'd say, oh yeah, but can I have a little help from you along the way? And they'd always say yes. And that was really key.
And as we move forward, I know that nobody has a crystal ball, but you guys have had, I mean, you've had this journey that has taken a few different turns that, you know, started one location, expanded to several locations, and now you guys are on to more locations. As you sit where you are now, looking, you know, we are, for those listening to the podcast in the future, we're in February of 2021, still in the midst of a pandemic.
Yeah.
As you look at what even just the next 12 months means for the unique outdoor lodging space and collective retreats as an organization, what do you see?
Yeah, I see such a big opportunity. First thing, I think that for anyone in this funky little space that we're in, or who's passionate about wanting to be into it, this is such a critical time, Ruben. And I don't know, I imagine you might agree with this, but so we've been fortunate because since we started Collective Retreats, we've seen the growth of the space for years. And it's been a pretty steady, you know, interesting, really exciting growth rate. It's sort of been like one of these kind of lines. You can't see the screen on the podcast, but I'm using my arm to indicate a pretty steady up into the top line that grows over a long period of time. COVID has triggered everyone to rethink their lives. And for decades, our lives have been getting more inundated by digital devices. Calendars have been getting packed. We've been jamming ourselves into smaller dwellings in tighter places. You know, our lives have become overly Starbucks-sized and McDonald's-sized and all these things that just make repetition and ease of use reliable. And everyone is starting, what we're seeing, and I'd be interested in hearing if you're seeing this, Ruben, but everyone's starting to say, how can we reconnect with nature? And how can we reconnect with cool places in the outdoors? And how can we take our sort of leisure time and outdoors time really seriously in a way that we haven't before? And it's sort of like a floodgate has opened, which is super exciting. I'm excited about it because obviously the pandemic is terrible and there's nothing exciting about that. But the fact that we get to help people through it in a unique and special way is really exciting to me. And I think that we've, in recent generations or decades, we've sort of moved away from what biologically and evolutionarily is what we need, right? Connection to the outdoors and seeing cool places and immersing ourselves in them and connecting to nature. And I think COVID has really flipped the switch for a lot of people to revalue that. And so that what that means for our space is that we have this time to sort of prove that there's a good way to do it and that we can help people connect to that. And if we do it well, they will be lifers, right? All those folks and they'll share it within the story of their lives on social media and through friends and family and word of mouth. And so I think it's a really important time because I feel like the space that we're in was a little bit of a tinderbox and it lit. I don't know. Are you feeling the same thing, Ruben?
Yeah, no. And I think you're spot on. And what we're excited about is that the glamping space has definitely become this gateway to the outdoors that, as you've put it, forcing us to kind of rethink what our travel priorities are and the ability for us to just take a step back and say, how do we really want to travel? Glamping has given people an opportunity who maybe not ready for RVs, they're not ready to be sleeping on the floor and go camping and so on, giving them the opportunity to really take a step back and say, you know, I want to be out in Mother Nature. I want a unique experience, you know, and in your case, these beautiful areas with great cuisine and, you know, high level of comfort, just something that really is more in line with their priorities.
Yeah. Great.
Well, Peter, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today. We are big fans of everything that you have done, are doing, will continue to do. We're very happy you didn't stop at the Vail property and you kept on moving along. So we're very excited for everything that's on the horizon for Collective Retreats. And thank you for taking the time to share your story. And we really appreciate it and looking forward to seeing you and hanging out in person here sooner than later.
Yeah, thanks, Ruben. And I think you know I'm a big supportive, and everyone at Collective Retreats, I'm a big supportive and a member personally of American Glamping Association. And I think what we in the Glamping Association are doing as work for the space is really important. So thank you for being our fearless leader in that effort, and really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter. We appreciate it. And we know that you guys will have a great 2021 season, but looking forward to seeing how everything shakes out.
Thanks, Ruben.
Again, and as always, thanks for joining us today. For more information about the American Glamping Association, please visit AmericanGlampingAssociation.net or feel free to reach out to info@AmericanGlampingAssociation.net. Until next time.